the laws of Baha'u'llah, try to be a source of attraction to your fellow men, an example to other Baha'is and to other people, and certainly to your own children. Pray that you may be successful, serve to the best of your ability, and leave the rest to God, because there isn't anything else that we can do. We don't seem to be able to go any further than that. But then, whatever part is in our own hands, it seems to me the important thing today is to be sure that this part that I do have, I don't foolishly drop and go and grab something that is absolutely trash compared to what I already had, you know. To leave the most precious thing in life for something that is entirely secondary in value. And I think this is the most that any of us can wish for each other. Wish that whatever the future holds, whatever happens, each one of us may not let slip from our hands this blessing that we have heard of Baha'u'llah, that we have accepted his teachings, that we love him and want to serve him and hope that till the very end we may remain faithful in his path. This is really the whole object of existence, not only according to the Baha'i teachings, according to every religion in the world. This is the primary, what shall I say, precept of theology. This is sound theology for every religion in the whole world. So what more can we wish for each other? That we will be those kind of Baha'is that Baha'u'llah wants us to be. I think that here, just like everywhere else in the world, the Baha'is stand at a turning point. And I don't say this lightly, because I'm a person that really tries not to just, you know, say something and I'm not sure that I mean it or that there's any justification for saying it. But I do really feel that we're going to see a great change in the near future. I don't know whether that means in a week, a month, a year, or 10 years, frankly. But there's no doubt in my mind that because of the persecution of our fellow Baha'is in Persia, because of the world crisis which is deepening, the forces that are let loose in the world today, that there has got to be a greater confirmation poured out on the heads of the Baha'is all over the world, and also many, many more people, if they're going to turn to the faith and are capable of turning to the faith, will do so. You know, I think it must be the atmosphere of Scotland that's got me so much on theology today, because it's a very religious part of the world, let's put it that way. But I think that we have to realize that not everybody is in a condition to come alive spiritually. Now, what God does with his own race when they die, I don't know. I'm neither God, nor frankly is it any of my business. The human race is born, and the human race dies, and it goes to God. On what state, he knows, and what he does with it, he knows too. I don't. But I do know that in this world, people can be in very different conditions. You know, Ali, the son of the son-in-law of Muhammad, the cousin of Muhammad, his son-in-law, made a contract. And two men came. One was selling a piece of land, one was buying a piece of land. And they asked him to witness this contract. So he wrote, "This day, a dead man, so-and-so, sold a piece of land," and described the piece of land, "to a dead man, so-and-so." He put it in the contract. They were perfectly alive. They were there, they were sitting, and they were having this land transaction. And then you remember the words of Jesus Christ, "Let the dead come, bury the dead. Come ye and follow me." Well, what did he mean? He was perfectly serious. The people that were following that funeral were spiritually dead, but his disciples were spiritually alive because they had accepted him, they had recognized him, they had come alive in the Holy Spirit, you see. And I think we have to realize that a lot of the people in this world are not capable of coming alive. As I said, what God does with them, I don't know. None of my business. But I do know that those that are alive must always constitute a percentage of any place that we are. Because anybody who knows mathematics knows that there's always mathematical percentages. They may be very low, they may be medium, they may be high, but there's always a percentage somewhere in it. And there's got to be a percentage of people anywhere and everywhere that are ready to accept the teachings of Baha'u'llah if they hear about it, if they're exposed to it. So our job, it seems to me, is to see that they hear about it, and to see that they hear about it in a way, as much as we are capable of, that isn't a test to them. Because so often we present the teachings of Baha'u'llah, which are certainly perfect, and which, in theory at least, only people who are very sick spiritually or very fanatical with closed minds could certainly find something in it that they believed in, you see. We present it in a way that, for some reason or other, cuts the other person off. And I think that the great art of teaching is, as I often look at it, like a doctor. A good doctor sits behind his desk, and when the patient comes in, he lets the patient talk, you see. And then he looks at the patient and says, well, this man is liverish, this man is heartish, this person looks very peculiar, they must have something the matter with their gallbladder or something. And a good doctor can see already by looking at the person a little bit about them. And then he lets the patient talk. And listening to the patient, he begins to form a picture of what is the matter with the patient, you see. But there's a method, in other words, and I often think that if we Baha'is were a little more patient with people we meet, if we let them do a little of the talking to empty themselves a little, well, then maybe they would let us do a little of the talking and they would be able to hear what it is we are saying. Because people have this terrible longing often to unburden themselves, to express themselves, to say something. Maybe they're lonely, maybe they live alone, maybe they're unhappy, maybe they have problems, you see. And the Baha'is, I don't mean any particular person or all of them, but they aren't very receptive. They're so anxious to get a word in edgewise, you see. Now, I've got to tell him. Well, all right, I agree, you ought to tell him if possible, but on the other hand, you can't force it into him unless perhaps he's able to empty himself a little bit so he can hear what you're saying and receive from you. I think the Baha'is, as I said the other day, in a number of these different meetings I've been in, I think the Baha'is have to be careful how they use the greeting, Allahu Akbar, because it means something to the Persians. Whenever I meet Persian Baha'is, as I now speak Persian, our greeting to each other in Persian is Allahu Akbar, and it has been from the days when we wanted to show that we followed Baha'u'llah, you see, after the crisis that arose at the time of the martyrdom of the Bab. In order for the Baha'is to show they were the followers of Baha'u'llah, they started saying as a greeting, Allahu Akbar. And Abdu'l-Bahá has made it quite clear this will be the greeting of the future, but he didn't say when the future was, you see. Where Shoghi Effendi said, and it's written and has been published a number of times in the American Baha'i News, the International Baha'i News, that we should be very circumspect in the use of this greeting in front of non-Baha'is, lest they get the wrong impression and lest it be a test to them. And I know I have to be very, very careful of my Canadian, very conservative, non-Baha'i Christian relatives. Because if I took them to a Baha'i meeting and they heard everybody shouting Allahu Akbar, they'd say, what is this thing, you see? Well, I don't know. It's got some kind of a catchphrase and it's something peculiar about it. And they probably wouldn't ever want to come back to another Baha'i meeting or meet any more Baha'is, you see? So really, I mean, seriously, for over 30 years, my cousins that I am hoping will eventually, before they die, open their eyes a little bit and at least read a few Baha'i books and find out what it is I've spent my whole life at, because they love me very much and admire me. I have never been able to introduce them to any Baha'is in Canada, because I didn't know what they would be exposed to, and I wasn't going to have 30 years of work undone in one meeting by something that created the wrong impression. Now, I don't know, you all live here, you do as you want, but I'm just making the suggestion that when we approach people, especially people that are very deep in their churches, the way they are in this part of the world, very much their own people, often, depending on where they live, a sense that anything that isn't Scottish is foreign, that anything that isn't from the Shetlands is a foreign element, you see, then you have to be twice as careful not to create an impression that in any way might immediately bring down a shutter between you and the very people that you're trying to attract and teach. We have to use the right lure, like somebody going fishing. Use the right bait so you'll catch the fish. Use the right shot so that you'll be able to shoot the prey and get it. And I think we do that, we should do that much more thoughtfully as we teach as Baha'is. But the main thing, of course, is to live the life and exemplify it, and also spread these wonderful teachings so other people can hear about it and understand it. When we were in the Orkney, something very touching happened. When one day, in between meetings, we had time, we walked up the main street. And we went into a shop and said what a nice place it was. I don't know, some remark to the girl running this shop. And she said, well, you're going to be here long. I said, no, I've just come over for a meeting, and I'm only here two nights. She said, really? What kind of a meeting? Well, I said, I've come to see the Baha'is in the Orkneys. I'm a Baha'i. And she said, oh. She said, we had a Baha'i here, and she mentioned this Persian Baha'i who repaired watches. What was his name? Dariush. She couldn't even pronounce it properly. It became something quite different in Orkney. And, she said, he was such a fine man. And she said, everybody liked him. And while he was here, we knew so much more about the Baha'i faith. We heard so much more about it than we do now. So you see, there's just one Baha'i. And yet, look at the reaction of the people of that town. They hadn't forgotten him. They were glad to meet another Baha'i because of him. They wished that they had him back again, and somebody would be a little bit more in the forefront with the Baha'i faith or whatever it was. So that we can do so much individually. And this is our great blessing and our great challenge. I think, friends, that it's getting on now, and it'd be nice to have some questions. I always like very much if we can have some questions from the friends.
Going to start. I just wanted to say I think we should let you sink in for those things. Please.
Well, if you want to know what their objectives are, I'm sure that a member of the National Assembly would be delighted to get you in a corner and give you about 18 different missions if you're open to suggestions. But I can remember that Shoghi Effendi had a high esteem of the people in this part of the world. And he used to say that it was very hard to convert them, that they were very slow to accept the Baha'i faith. But then once they became Baha'is, they were practically immovable. They didn't accept it lightly. And when they were convinced, why, that was it. They hung on, you see. And I can only remember offhand one other group of people that he used to liken to the British in this quality, and that was the Turkish people. He said that the Turks were like that, that they used to, that they were so hard, you know, to get them to accept anything, just get it into their head, get them to take on anything new. But that once they did, that was it. Nothing could move them after that. And, of course, he had a great admiration for the British Baha'is and for their achievements, and was very happy over the things that were done in Great Britain before his passing. And they went ahead and did things that, frankly, lots of other communities never did. They inaugurated plans of their own, and then they went to work and won those plans. But the British National Assembly has published the letters of Shoghi Effendi recently, and that should be an interesting thing for you to read. I presume my copy is waiting in Haifa for me. Well, I don't see any reason why I shouldn't answer this question now. I wouldn't have answered it 30 years ago, but I'll answer it today. Where exactly was the eagle that was used as a model for the one on the guardian's grave purchased? Down on Princess Street, going down the hill towards Holyrood Castle, in that direction, on the left-hand side, there was a very, very famous antique shop, run by a woman who somebody yesterday in an antique shop told me that they knew very well. I thought she was Scottish. She was Jewish. And she was Mrs. something or other. I don't remember the name. And she's since passed away, and the shop doesn't exist anymore. But when we came here, Shoghi Effendi was, you know, furnishing the mansion, and adding to the things in the holy places. If he saw things that were appropriate, he added to the ornaments in the shrines and removed things that were inferior in quality or damaged. He never looked for antiques in the true sense of the word. He was neither a connoisseur nor was he interested in trying to build up an antique collection. He was interested in trying to create an effect. And he had a genius, frankly, for doing it. He had this marvelous, marvelous sense of proportion. And if you go to the holy places and look at them with the eye of a connoisseur, if you do know anything about antiques, you'll see that a great deal of the stuff is not good at all. It wouldn't come under the heading of an antique. But he had such taste that he arranged it in such a fascinating way that it looks like $1 million, whereas the initial outlay was very little. So he used to buy things, as I said, for this purpose, and mainly in England. And as we were here in Edinburgh, we had a look around to a few places. One of them was that woman's shop. And there was this beautiful eagle, which is now in the archives. And it's on a sort of a cliff of wood. It's very Japanese. And this eagle that I think was made of, what, bronze or something, and silvered, is very lovely. You've seen Shoghi Effendi's tomb with this eagle on the top, and it has one wing down and one like that. And you really can't tell whether the bird is just coming in or just going off. It's a very beautiful position. Well, he loved that thing. And we had it sent back to Haifa, and he liked it so much. He didn't like lots of things. Shoghi Effendi had very limited, you might say, specific tastes. He liked a few dishes and a few this and a few that, and conservative more or less, and simple. But what he liked very much. And he liked that eagle. And he put it on a table near his bed in his bedroom, which was also his office. I couldn't get him to separate the two because he would sit at his desk and work, and when he was too tired to sit up anymore, he'd get into bed and work. And, of course, I used to remonstrate that it's not good to have your office and your bedroom one room. You should have them separate so that you can, you know, go to bed here and have a rest here, and then that's the place you work. But he couldn't. He had too much work to do, and that was the way he had to do it. So this eagle was in that room, and he enjoyed it so much. And then all guarded a column. He wanted a Corinthian column. And, of course, he'd seen them in Italy and other places. And although he had the archives building, he wanted one. And I said, well, Shoghi Effendi, I don't see how you can have one. I don't know where you'd put it. You just can't put a column like that, you know, all by itself. And he accepted that, but he looked a little dubious about it, as much as say, I still want my column. So something very strange happened after he passed away. I won't go into that because it upsets me too much. But it was very sudden, as you know. And when I was driving away from his grave, I went and visited it just before I left London with Mrs. Collins, and the car was driving away from the grave. Of course, there was nothing but flowers there. In front of my eyes, I saw the whole thing. I saw the foundation and the column and the globe and the eagle. Just like that. And I made a little sketch, I remember, in the car, a tiny little thing like that. And when I went back and all the hands of the cause came to the Holy Land and had the first conclave, the first meeting to think about rescuing the faith from this terrible catastrophe, you see, and holding everything steady till we could have the House of Justice, I showed them this sketch. And I said, this is what I feel we should build over the resting place of the guardian. So it was decided that's what we would do. Couldn't possibly move him. It wasn't the time to think about it and so on. And I didn't know where to get an eagle. And then suddenly one night I thought, well, what about that eagle in his room? Because, of course, his room was closed up after he passed away. And I went up and carried this thing down in my arms, and the hand of the cause, Mr. Fazy, was there, and Alice Kidder, who was living with me at that time. And Fazy got off in a corner and stood on something, and he held this eagle way up like that. And then I looked at it, and I realized that it was perfect. So I took it in my arms and wouldn't let anybody else carry it, and took it to Rome. And with Dr. Giacchieri, we got the architect who had helped in building the shrine and the stones for the archives and so on. And he came up, showed him what we wanted. So he made the design, brought it full scale while I waited in Rome so we could approve of the proportions. And then I left the eagle there to be enlarged to the appropriate size. And then, of course, in the end, it came back to Haifa. Dr. Giacchieri, as I remember, brought it home. So that's the story of that very beautiful eagle, and it came from Edinburgh. Well, you come and read this, and then I'll answer.
The Guardian wrote that the cardinal principles of the administrative order the authority of assemblies and the power and initiative of the individuals. Why do we have either dictatorial assemblies or those who believe in an excessive liberalism individuals?
Well, I should say just because we're weak and imperfect, that's all. I mean, after all, look at us. Who are we? I don't know who you think you are. I don't think I'm anything so extraordinary. And we're just ordinary human beings. We're a slice of the human race. And some of us have better judgment, and some of us have poorer judgment, and some of us have more patience, and some of us have less patience, and some of us get all nervous and go by the letter of the law, and others are a little bit more relaxed and willing to do things in a more relaxed manner. It takes all kinds of people. But one of the things that I often think causes particularly inside administrative bodies, a certain amount of tension, let's put it that way, and sometimes a certain amount of inharmony, is our sincerity. And I think that that may sound very strange, but we're so sincere You see, anything that has to do with a man's feeling about his God and his religion is really the deepest thing in his life, because it concerns him here, now, and it concerns him forever. So it's something you feel very passionately, you see. And therefore, you're very, very sincere about it. You're also very heavy about it, because you're taking it so seriously. And it often, people, my experience, and God knows I've had enough of it at this age, is that people, because of this intense sincerity, because it's their religion, they get so keyed up and tense that they get upset over things with very little swing with the punches, so to say, that they would have in normal relationships. In a business, they wouldn't get so upset. In an office, if they had things to discuss, in research work, laboratory work, they wouldn't get that head up over it, you see. But because it's the spiritual obligation, they're on the assembly, it means so much, they get very tense. Now, my father was a very wonderful person, and he was very, very Scottish. And he had this marvelous Scotch wit. And he used to joke about things. Really. He would begin to make people laugh. Sometimes in the feast, you know, there'd be some kind of a crisis. I can remember one very, very clearly in Montreal Baha'i community. We had a young school teacher, and it was the time of the exams, and she was exhausted and working very hard. She was the chairman of our assembly at that point. And there was a young man who was very attached to her, in love with her, also at that point. She didn't marry him, but whatever it was, at that moment he had a crush on her. And there was, I don't know, we were perhaps 15, 20 Baha'is in the community and having our 19-day feast. And during the discussion of the activities of the community, the assembly was asked some question, you know, what are you doing about the publicity or this or that? And she got very upset. And she began to cry. She burst into tears and she said, you don't have any confidence in your spiritual assembly and so on. And the tears rolled down her face. And I was sitting next to this young man and he got terribly tense too. And he said to himself in an undertone, he said, my idea of a 19-day feast is hell. Well, you see, look how tense the whole thing was. And my father just began to joke. He said, oh, I don't know whether it's as bad as all that, you know. And in that light vein, he began to joke, and he got us all laughing. And something that could have gone on as a rift in the community for 8 months or so passed off before the refreshments were served. You see, because he made them relax, he made them laugh, he made them see the funny side of it. And I think that this is something that we Baha'is, frankly, don't do enough. We get like this, you see, because it's got to do with God. We get very keyed up, and that sometimes leads to a little bit of heavy-handedness on the part of administrative bodies. They take themselves very seriously. They get a little officious. Now, why other people have to take it so lightly, I don't know. I suppose that that's just because lots of people come into the faith in a period when everything's the permissive society, you see. If you think about the amount of freedom we have in the world today and the way the word freedom is bandied around, freedom to strike and freedom to have a revolution and freedom to throw a bomb and freedom to shoot somebody and freedom to walk out on your wife and children, freedom, whatever you feel like doing, that's it, I've got to do my thing sort of thing. There's a great deal of that, and sometimes people enter the faith with this attitude because that's the attitude of the society from which they came. So they're the other extreme. Well, all right, so what? We can't help it. We can't wait till we're perfect to become Baha'is. Let's all become Baha'is together and do the best we can. And above all, when we have problems, pray more about it. Because that, pray more about it perhaps, and maybe joke a little bit about it. And that should solve some of the problems. It says it has been reported that Abdu'l-Bahá said Scotland is the land of Joseph. Do you know any more about this? No, I'd never heard that. And I really truthfully don't. But I think that eventually a great deal more will be known about things because the history of the Baha'i faith will be better coordinated. You know, we have in Haifa now, somebody told me the statistic last year, over 35,000 letters of Shoghi Effendi. Well, you can imagine. Now, of course, all of those are not tomes and full of new information, but still, it's all little cross threads. And gradually, perhaps, we'll be able to understand a question like that and answer it, but I don't know. Why are under 21 not invited to the feast, although allowed to attend? Well, I thought that everybody just knew that there was a 19-day feast or the 9 holy days, and that the community was informed by the assembly or by the group that the feast would be at such and such a place at such and such a time. And I don't think that you invite or don't invite 21-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 88-year-olds, or anything else. You just, everybody knew there was a meeting here today and the time of it, you see. And nobody sent individual invitations, you're in the 21 category, don't forget to turn up. It was just a meeting, you see, for the Baha'is. And I think the 19-day feast is just like that, too. Nobody has to be ignored. Nobody has to be singled out. There's just going to be that occasion, and it's going to be at such and such a time. And you are welcome to attend it as a Baha'i.
I think it's fair if I call on somebody who had his hand up first. Dr. Fanana Fazir.
Can I answer this?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. How's it?
As I was coming here to this meeting, here you speak, both the newspaper, the newspaper of this country has come in times. It says in it, it mentions the name of the faith, the Baha'i faith. It says that 162 Baha'is makes it into the faith. I was coming here, and everybody in the hospital where I work, they had this paper on the ward, the doctors, the patients. I was coming today, I was finding it difficult mentally, or spiritually, mentally, to adjust all these things in my mind. We know that we are working very hard on the cost of justice and national solutions. Individuals like you, born in Russia, living in the West, opening a newspaper, seeing a news like that, coming and hearing you speak, it's all sometimes becomes difficult mentally to make sense of the world.
Well, in what sense doesn't it make sense?
How can working amongst the people in this country to open a newspaper and knowing that I'm a Baha'i, all my teachers, all my lecturers, all my consultants, knowing that I'm a Baha'i, they see that my fellow countrymen have been executed for their faith. And then they just live their life, they live their own life, they live as if that country and that nation. Those people are something different. They watch their television. They go to their sports. I find that sometimes it's very difficult in the end of the day to make an impression, as you said. This is God's fault, given the fault. How do you end up on stage?
Well, I don't know whether you're going to like my answer, but it seems to me that it's terrible for us. And it is different for us that the Baha'is are being killed because the Baha'is are so innocent. When I was in Central America and had a lot of press interviews and things, they would say, and public talks, and then somebody from the floor would say, well, all right, people are being killed in your religion in Persia, but then what about the people in El Salvador? They are being killed. What about the revolution over there? What about those people that were all shot down the other day? Well, I said, look, I think you have to make one distinction. I don't approve of anybody being shot, and I don't approve of bloodshed. I don't approve of terrorism or anything. Don't approve of killing. But You have to make a distinction between people who are terrorists because they want to be, people who are revolutionaries and deliberately join a political party and use revolution as a means of getting in power because they think they're right, whatever their philosophy may be, you see. You have to put people that are totally non-combatant, obedient to government, non-political, and have no sin whatsoever except to believe in Baha'u'llah and his teachings, which are certainly the most progressive in the world today, and you cannot lump those two things together. Therefore, the Baha'is are really the persecution of the innocents. But I don't think that you can expect people to react the way you do to it, because that's not natural that they should. All of us, I think, in the world today cannot, and I think that's perhaps true of the Baha'is also, we cannot, I don't know how to put it, we cannot allow the full force of what is happening to our brothers and sisters in Persia to lay us low. You see what I mean? There's a defensive mechanism in people that they'll absorb so much catastrophe, unpleasantness, or whatever it is that they hear. Not so much as it's been done to me deliberately right now, but what I hear or read, I can only take in a certain amount of it, and then the immunity goes up, you see. Then I say, well, all right, I can't help it. I'll be a better Baha'i. I'll go on a teaching trip in their name. I'll give to the fund in their name. I'll teach more actively. I'll try and compensate. But to burn in the same fire that they are burning in, I don't think that we can. Because most of us aren't made like that. Human beings will not jump into a fire that is lit over, 3,000 or 4,000 miles away, no matter how badly they feel about the whole thing, you see. You are Persian, probably lots of these people you knew when I heard that Dr. Farhangi, my own colleague, so to speak, one of the counselors, had been killed. Well, I felt terribly about all the Persian Baha'is that were killed. But when I could visualize Farhangi being shot, you see, knowing him personally, knowing that he was ill when we asked him to remain as a counselor in Persia, knowing that he'd been the prison doctor, hoping he wouldn't be killed because he was the doctor and they'd need him, you see. So they'd say, oh no, for heaven's sake, don't kill the only doctor we've got in the prison. He's taking care of us. But no, he got killed too. So that personal contact hit me harder than others that I didn't know of except by reputation. And I think that's true of all of us. It's got to hit the Persians harder than it hits people who don't have that intimate contact, many of you. It's your relatives that are being killed, you see, your relatives that are in jail. And that's true all over the Baha'i world in the West now, not to mention Persia. So you must be patient with people who aren't you, you see. They feel it, and I'm sure they'll express it. I don't think there's any doubt that you're going to see that the Baha'is of the West express their sympathy for their Persian brethren in action, not necessarily weeping and in words, but they're going to express it in action increasingly strongly, because that's the kind of people we are. Well, I've got another question. What does this say? I think you should answer this, Ms. Wong. I don't know what the policy of the National Assembly is.
The question reads, the National Spiritual Assembly has asked us to get in touch with various organizations and ask them to write to Iranian authorities and object to the treatment of the friends. Can we get in touch with our personal friends or people we have thought about the faith? Sorry, we have taught about the faith to do the same. Would you please elaborate? With your permission, Colonel.
Yes.
Instructions of the National Assembly were very clear that, one, we send cables to the United Nations Secretary General, Kurt Waldheim. We try to get publicity out of the event, but when we contact people in authority, we request them that they in turn will either directly contact the government in Iran or do it through the United Nations again. And you remember the National Assembly shared with you the copies of the two letters as an example, the two letters that came from the dons of the University of Oxford, which was sent to Dr. Kurt Waldheim, and in it they requested the United Nations to interfere directly on behalf of the Baha'is of the world, and they linked it with the United Kingdom very nicely, in order to remove the present crisis of the faith there. This is what we want to do. As far as contacting the personal friends, if they are British personal friends, of course that is the way it's going to be done, and the more we do, the better. But not Iranian friends who are here, who are mostly anti-government and are politically linked somehow or another. These people we do not want to contact. I don't know whether this has answered the question as asked.
Mr. Sabti.
Can I just speak to the
question? Permission of
Fran. Okay, I think you can.